Chapter 21. The clock strikes 3. Miss Cook and Miss Barrow arrived very promptly at 8:45. One wore beige lace and the other one a shade of olive green. During dinner, Anthea had asked Miss Marple about these two ladies.
"It seems very funny of them," she said, "to want to stay behind."
"Oh, I don't think so," said Miss Marple. "I think it is really quite natural. They have a rather exact plan, I imagine."
"What do you mean by a plan?" asked Mrs. Glynn.
"Well, I should think they are always prepared for various eventualities and have a plan for dealing with them."
"Do you mean," said Anthea with some interest, "do you mean that they had a plan for dealing with murder?"
"I wish," said Mrs. Glynn, "that you wouldn't talk of poor Miss Temple's death as murder."
"But of course it's murder," said Anthea. "All I wonder is who wanted to murder her. I should think probably some pupil of hers at the school who always hated her and had it in for her."
"Do you think hate can last as long as that?" asked Miss Marple.
"Oh, I should think so. I should think you could hate anyone for years."
"No," said Miss Marple, "I think hate would die out. You could try and keep it up artificially, but I think you would fail. It's not as strong a force as love," she added.
"Don't you think that Miss Cook or Miss Barrow or both of them might have done the murder?"
"Why should they?" said Mrs. Glynn. "Really, Anthea, they seemed very nice women to me."
"I think there's something rather mysterious about them," said Anthea. "Don't you, Clotilde?"
"I think perhaps you're right," said Clotilde. "They seem to me to be slightly artificial, if you know what I mean."
"I think there's something very sinister about them," said Anthea.
"You've got such an imagination always," said Mrs. Glynn. "Anyway, they were walking along the bottom path, weren't they? You saw them there, didn't you?" she said to Miss Marple.
"I can't say that I noticed them particularly," said Miss Marple. "In fact, I had no opportunity of doing so."
"You mean she wasn't there," said Clotilde. "She was here, in our garden."
"Oh, of course, I forgot."
"A very nice, peaceful day it was," said Miss Marple. "I enjoyed it very much. Tomorrow morning I would like to go out and look again at that mass of white flowers coming into bloom at the end of the garden, near that raised-up mound. It was just beginning to come out the other day. It must be a mass of bloom now. I shall always remember that as part of my visit here, you know."
"I hate it," said Anthea. "I want it taken away. I want to build up a greenhouse again there. Surely if we save enough money we can do that, Clotilde?"
"We'll leave that alone," said Clotilde. "I don't want that touched. What use is a greenhouse to us now? It would be years before grapes would bear fruit again."
"Come," said Mrs. Glynn. "We can't go on arguing over that. Let us go into the drawing-room. Our guests will be coming shortly for coffee."
It was then that the guests had arrived. Clotilde brought in the tray of coffee. She poured out the cups and distributed them. She placed one before each guest and then brought one to Miss Marple.
Miss Cook leaned forward.
"Oh, do forgive me, Miss Marple, but really, do you know, I shouldn't drink that if I were you. Coffee, I mean, at this time of night. You won't sleep properly."
"Oh, do you think so?" said Miss Marple. "I'm quite used to coffee in the evening."
"Yes, but this is very strong, good coffee. I should advise you not to drink it."
Miss Marple looked at Miss Cook. Miss Cook's face was very earnest. Her fair, unnatural-looking hair flopped over one eye. The other eye blinked slightly.
"I see what you mean," said Miss Marple. "Perhaps you are right. You know something, I gather, about diet."
"Oh, yes. I make quite a study of it. I had some training in nursing, you know, and one thing and another."
"Indeed?"
Miss Marple pushed the cup away slightly.
"I suppose there is no photograph of this girl," she asked. "Verity Hunt, or whatever her name was. The Archdeacon was talking about her. He seemed to have been very fond of her."
"I think he was. He was fond of all young people," said Clotilde.
She got up, went across the room, and lifted the lid of a desk. From that she brought a photograph and brought it over for Miss Marple to see.
"That was Verity," she said.
"A beautiful face," said Miss Marple. "Yes, a very beautiful and unusual face. Poor child."
"It's dreadful nowadays," said Anthea. "These things seem to be happening the whole time. Girls going out with every kind of young man. Nobody taking any trouble to look after them."
"They have to look after themselves nowadays," said Clotilde. "And they've no idea how to do it, heaven help them."
She stretched out her hand to take back the photograph from Miss Marple. As she did so, her sleeve caught the coffee cup and knocked it to the floor.
"Oh, dear," said Miss Marple. "Was that my fault? Did I jog your arm?"
"No," said Clotilde. "It was my sleeve. It's rather a floating sleeve. Perhaps you would like some hot milk if you're afraid to take coffee."
"That would be very kind," said Miss Marple. "A glass of hot milk when I go to bed would be very soothing indeed, and always gives one a good night."
After a little more desultory conversation, Miss Cook and Miss Barrow took their departure. A rather fussy departure, in which first one and then the other came back to collect some article they'd left behind, a scarf, a handbag, and a pocket handkerchief.
"Fuss, fuss, fuss," said Anthea when they had departed.
"Somehow," said Mrs. Glynn, "I agree with Clotilde that those two don't seem real, if you know what I mean," she said to Miss Marple.
"Yes," said Miss Marple, "I do rather agree with you. They don't seem very real. I have wondered about them a good deal. Wondered, I mean, why they came on this tour, and if they were really enjoying it, and what was their reason for coming."
"And have you discovered the answers to all those things?" asked Clotilde.
"I think so," said Miss Marple. She sighed. "I've discovered the answers to a lot of things," she said.
"Up to now, I hope you've enjoyed yourself," said Clotilde.
"I'm glad to have left the tour now," said Miss Marple. "I don't think I should have enjoyed much more of it."
"No, I can quite understand that."
Clotilde fetched a glass of hot milk from the kitchen and accompanied Miss Marple up to her room.
"Is there anything else I can get you?" she asked. "Anything at all?"
"No, thank you," said Miss Marple. "I have everything I want. I have my little night bag here, you see, so I need not do any more unpacking." "Thank you," she said. "It is very kind of you and your sisters to put me up again tonight."
"Well, we couldn't do much less, having had Mr. Raphael's letter. He was a very thoughtful man."
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "The kind of man who, well, thinks of everything. A good brain, I should think."
"I believe he was a very noted financier."
"Financially and otherwise, he thought of a lot of things," said Miss Marple. "Oh, well, I shall be glad to get to bed. Good night, Miss Bradbury Scott."
"Shall I send you breakfast up in the morning? You'd like to have it in bed?"
"No, no, I wouldn't put you out for the world. No, no, I would rather come down. A cup of tea, perhaps, would be very nice, but I want to go out in the garden. I particularly want to see that mound, all covered with white flowers. So beautiful and so triumphant."
"Good night," said Clotilde. "Sleep well."
In the hall of the old manor house, the grandfather clock at the bottom of the stairs struck 2 o'clock. The clocks in the house did not all strike in unison, and some of them, indeed, did not strike at all. To keep a house full of antique clocks in working order was not easy. At 3 o'clock, the clock on the first floor landing struck a soft chime 3 o'clock. A faint chink of light showed through the hinge of the door. Miss Marple sat up in bed and put her fingers on the switch of the electric lamp by her bed. The door opened very softly. There was no light outside now, but the soft footstep came through the door into the room. Miss Marple switched the light on.
"Oh," she said, "it's you, Miss Bradbury Scott. Is there anything special?"
"I just came to see if you wanted anything," said Miss Bradbury Scott.
Miss Marple looked at her. Clotilde had on a long purple robe. What a handsome woman she was, thought Miss Marple, her hair framing her forehead, a tragic figure, a figure of drama. Again Miss Marple thought of Greek plays, Clytemnestra again.
You're sure there is nothing I can bring you?
No, thank you, said Miss Marple. I'm afraid, she said apologetically, that I have not drunk my milk.
Oh, dear, why not?
I did not think it would be very good for me, said Miss Marple.
Clotilde stood there at the foot of the bed, looking at her.
Not wholesome, you know, said Miss Marple.
Just what do you mean by that?
Clotilde's voice was harsh now.
I think you know what I mean, said Miss Marple. I think you've known all evening, perhaps before that.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
No.
There was a faint satirical note to the questioning monosyllable.
I'm afraid the milk is cold now. I will take it away and get you some hot.
Clotilde stretched out a hand and took the glass of milk from the bedside.
Don't trouble yourself, said Miss Marple. Even if you brought it me, I should not drink it.
I really cannot understand the point of what you're saying. Really, said Clotilde, looking at her, what a very extraordinary person you are. What sort of a woman are you? Why are you talking like this? Who are you?
Miss Marple pulled down the mass of pink wool that encircled her head, a pink wool scarf of the same kind that she had once worn in the West Indies.
One of my names, she said, is Nemesis.
Nemesis? And what does that mean?
I think you know, said Miss Marple. You are a very well-educated woman. Nemesis is long delayed sometimes, but it comes in the end.
What are you talking about?
About a very beautiful girl whom you killed, said Miss Marple.
Whom I killed? What do you mean?
I mean the girl Verity.
And why should I kill her?
Because you loved her, said Miss Marple.
Of course I loved her. I was devoted to her, and she loved me.
Somebody said to me not very long ago that love was a very frightening word. It is a frightening word. You loved Verity too much. She meant everything in the world to you. She was devoted to you until something else came into her life. A different kind of love came into her life. She fell in love with a boy, a young man, not a very suitable one, not a very good specimen, not anyone with a good record, but she loved him, and he loved her, and she wanted to escape. To escape from the burden of the bondage of love she was living in with you. She wanted a normal woman's life, to live with the man of her choice, to have children by him. She wanted marriage and the happiness of normality.
Clotilde moved. She came to a chair and sat down in it, staring at Miss Marple.
So, she said, you seem to understand very well.
Yes, I do understand.
What you say is quite true. I shan't deny it. It doesn't matter if I do or do not deny it.
No, said Miss Marple. You are quite right there. It will not matter.
Do you know at all? Can you imagine how I have suffered?
Yes, said Miss Marple. I can imagine it. I've always been able to imagine things.
Did you imagine the agony? The agony of thinking, of knowing you are going to lose the thing you love best in the world. And I was losing it to a miserable, depraved delinquent, a man unworthy of my beautiful, splendid girl. I had to stop it. I had to. I had to.
Yes, said Miss Marple. Sooner than let the girl go, you killed her. Because you loved her, you killed her.
Do you think I could ever do a thing like that? Do you think I could strangle the girl I loved? Do you think I could bash her face in, crush her head to a pulp? Nothing but a vicious, depraved man would do a thing like that.
No, said Miss Marple, you wouldn't do that. You loved her, and you would not be able to do that.
Well, then, you see, you are talking nonsense.
You didn't do that to her.
The girl that happened to was not the girl you loved.
Verity's here still, isn't she? She's here, in the garden. I don't think you strangled her. I think you gave her a drink of coffee or of milk. You gave her a painless overdose of sleeping stuff. And then, when she was dead, you took her out into the garden, you pulled aside the fallen bricks of the greenhouse, and you made a vault for her there, under the floor, with the bricks, and covered it over. And then the polygonum was planted there, and has flowered ever since, growing bigger and stronger every year. Verity has remained here with you. You never let her go.
You fool. You crazy old fool. Do you think you're ever going to get away to tell this story?
I think so, said Miss Marple. I am not quite sure of it. You are a strong woman, a great deal stronger than I am.
I'm glad you appreciate that.
And you wouldn't have any scruples, said Miss Marple. You know, one doesn't stop at one murder. I have noticed that in the course of my life and in what I have observed of crime. You killed two girls, didn't you? You killed the girl you loved, and you killed a different girl.
I killed a silly little tramp, an adolescent tart, Nora Broad. How did you know about her?
I wondered, said Miss Marple. I didn't think from what I saw of you that you could have borne to strangle and disfigure the girl you loved. But another girl disappeared also about that time, a girl whose body has never been found. But I thought the body had been found, only they hadn't known that the body was Nora Broad's. It was dressed in Verity's clothes. It was identified as Verity by the person who would be the first applied to, the person who knew her better than anyone else. You had to go and say if the body found was the body of Verity. You recognized it. You said that that dead body was Verity's.
And why should I do that?
Because you wanted the boy who had taken Verity away from you, the boy whom Verity had loved and who had loved Verity, you wanted him tried for murder. And so you hid that second body in a place where it would not be too easily discovered. When that was discovered, it would be thought to be the wrong girl. You would make sure that it was identified in the way you wanted. You dressed it in Verity's clothes, put her handbag there, a letter or two, a bangle, a little cross on a chain. You disfigured her face. A week ago, you committed a third murder, the murder of Elizabeth Temple. You killed her because she was coming to this part of the world, and you were afraid of what she might have known, from what Verity might have written to her or told her. And you thought that if Elizabeth Temple got together with Archdeacon Brabazon, they might, with what they both knew, come at some appraisal of the truth. Elizabeth Temple must not be allowed to meet the Archdeacon. You are a very powerful woman. You could have rolled that boulder down the hillside. It must have taken some doing, but you are a very strong woman.
Strong enough to deal with you, said Clotilde.
I don't think, said Miss Marple, that you will be allowed to do that.
What do you mean, you miserable, shriveled-up old woman?
Yes, said Miss Marple, I'm an elderly pussy, and I have very little strength in my arms or my legs, very little strength anywhere. But I am, in my own way, an emissary of justice. Clotilde laughed.
And who'll stop me from putting an end to you?
I think, said Miss Marple, my guardian angel.
Trusting to your guardian angel, are you? Said Clotilde, and laughed again.
She advanced towards the bed. Possibly two guardian angels, said Miss Marple. Mr. Raphael always did things on a lavish scale. Her hand slipped under the pillow and out again. In it was a whistle, which she put to her lips. It was something of a sensation in whistles. It had the shrill fury which would attract a policeman from the end of a street. Two things happened almost simultaneously. The door of the room opened. Clotilde turned. Miss Barrow was standing in the doorway. At the same moment, the large wardrobe hanging cupboard opened, and Miss Cook stepped out of it. There was a grim air of professionalism about them both, which was very noticeable in contrast to their pleasant social behaviour a little earlier in the evening. Two guardian angels, said Miss Marple happily. Mr. Raphael has done me very proud,
as one used to say. Chapter 22 Miss Marple tells her story.
"When did you find out?" asked Professor Wanstead, "that those two women were private agents accompanying you for your protection?"
He leaned forward in his chair, looking thoughtfully at the white-haired old lady who sat in an upright position in the chair opposite him. They were in an official government building in London, and there were four other persons present: an official from the Public Prosecutor's Office, the Assistant Commissioner of Scotland Yard, Sir James Lloyd, the Governor of Manston Prison, Sir Andrew McNeill. The fourth person was the Home Secretary.
"Not until the last evening," said Miss Marple. "I wasn't actually sure until then. Miss Cook had come to St. Mary Mead, and I found out fairly quickly that she was not what she represented herself to be, which was a woman knowledgeable in gardening, who had come there to help a friend with her garden. So I was left with the choice of deciding what her real object had been, once she had acquainted herself with my appearance, which was obviously the only thing she could have come for. When I recognized her again on the coach, I had to make up my mind if she was accompanying the tour in the role of guardianship, or whether those two women were enemies, enlisted by what I might call the other side. I was only really sure that last evening when Miss Cook prevented me, by very distinct words of warning, from drinking the cup of coffee that Clotilde Bradbury Scott had just set down in front of me. She phrased it very cleverly, but the warning was clearly there. Later, when I was wishing those two good night, one of them took my hand in both of hers, giving me a particularly friendly and affectionate handshake. And in doing so, she passed something into my hand, which, when I examined it later, I found to be a high-powered whistle. I took it to bed with me, accepted the glass of milk which was urged upon me by my hostess, and wished her good night, being careful not to change my simple and friendly attitude."
"You didn't drink the milk?"
"Of course not," said Miss Marple. "What do you take me for?"
"I beg your pardon," said Professor Wanstead. "It surprises me that you didn't lock your door."
"That would have been quite the wrong thing to do," said Miss Marple. "I wanted Clotilde Bradbury Scott to come in. I wanted to see what she would say or do. I thought it was almost certain that she would come in when sufficient time had elapsed to make sure that I had drunk the milk and was in an unconscious sleep from which, presumably, I would not have woken up again."
"Did you help Miss Cook to conceal herself in the wardrobe?"
"No. It was a complete surprise when she came out of that suddenly." "I suppose," said Miss Marple, thoughtfully, thinking it over, "I suppose she slipped in there just when I had gone down the passage to the bathroom."
"You knew the two women were in the house?"
"I thought they would be at hand somewhere after they'd given me the whistle. I do not think it was a difficult house to which to gain access. There were no shuttered windows or burglar alarms or anything of that kind. One of them came back on the pretext of having left a handbag and a scarf. Between them, they probably managed to leave a window unfastened, and I should imagine they came back into the house almost as soon as they left it, while the inhabitants inside were going up to bed."
"You took a big risk, Miss Marple."
"I hoped for the best," said Miss Marple. "One cannot go through life without attracting certain risks if they are necessary."
"Your tip about the parcel dispatched to that charity, by the way, was entirely successful. It contained a brand-new, brightly coloured man's polo-neck jumper in scarlet and black checks. Most noticeable. What made you think of that?"
"Well," said Miss Marple, "that was really very simple. The description that Emmeline and Joanna gave of the figure they had seen made it almost certain that these very bright-coloured and noticeable clothes were meant to be noticed, and that therefore it would be very important that they should not be hidden locally or kept among the person's own belongings. They must be got out of the way as soon as could be. And really there is only one way successfully of disposing of something. That is through the general post. Anything in the nature of clothes can be very easily dispatched to charities.
Think how pleased the people who collect winter garments for unemployed mothers, or whatever the name of the charity, would be to find a nearly brand new woolen jumper. All I had to do was to find out the address where it had been sent.
And you asked them that at the post office?
The Home Secretary looked slightly shocked. Not directly, of course. I mean, I had to be a little flustered and explain how I'd put the wrong address on some clothes that I was sending to a charity, and could they by any chance tell me if the parcel one of my kind hostesses had brought up there had been sent off? And a very nice woman there did her best and remembered that it was not the address I was hoping it had been sent to, and she gave me the address that she had noted. She had no suspicion, I think, that I had any wish for the information apart from being, well, rather muddle-headed, elderly, and very worried about where my parcel of worn clothes had gone.
Ah, said Professor Wanstead, I see you are an actress, Miss Marple, as well as an Avenger.
Then he said,
when did you first begin to discover what had happened 10 years ago?
To begin with, said Miss Marple, I found things very difficult, almost impossible. In my mind, I was blaming Mr. Raphael for not having made things clear to me. But I see now that he'd been very wise not to do so. Really, you know, he was extraordinarily clever. I can see why he was such a big financier and made so much money so easily. He laid his plans so well. He gave me just enough information in small packets each time. I was, as it were, directed. First, my guardian angels were alerted to note what I looked like. Then I was directed on the tour and to the people on it.
Did you suspect, if I may use that word, anyone on the tour at first?
Only as possibilities.
No feeling of evil.
Ah, you have remembered that. No. I did not think there was any definite atmosphere of evil. I was not told who my contact was there, but she made herself known to me.
Elizabeth Temple.
Yes, it was like a searchlight, said Miss Marple, illuminating things on a dark night. So far, you see, I had been in the dark. There were certain things that must be, must logically be, I mean, because of what Mr. Raphael had indicated. There must somewhere be a victim, and somewhere a murderer. Yes, a killer was indicated, because that was the only liaison that had existed between Mr. Raphael and myself. There had been a murder in the West Indies. Both he and I had been involved in it, and all he knew of me was my connection with that. So it could not be any other type of crime. And it could not either be a casual crime. It must be, and show itself definitely to be, the handiwork of someone who had accepted evil. Evil instead of good. There seemed to be two victims indicated. There must be someone who had been killed, and there must be clearly a victim of injustice. A victim who had been accused of a crime he or she had not committed. So now, while I pondered these things, I had no light upon them until I talked to Miss Temple. She was very intense, very compelling. There came the first link which I had with Mr. Raphael. She spoke of a girl she had known, a girl who had once been engaged to Mr. Raphael's son. Here, then, was my first ray of light. Presently, she also told me that the girl had not married him. I asked why not, and she said because she died. I asked then how she died, what had killed her, and she said very strongly, very compellingly, I can hear her voice still, it was like the sound of a deep bell, she said, love. And she said after that, the most frightening word there can be is love. I did not know then exactly what she meant. In fact, the first idea that came to me was that the girl had committed suicide as a result of an unhappy love affair. It can happen often enough, and a very sad tragedy it is when it does happen. That was the most I knew then. That, and the fact that the journey she herself was engaged upon was no mere pleasure tour. She was going, she told me, on a pilgrimage. She was going to some place or to some person.
I did not learn then who the person was. That only came later.
Archdeacon Brabazon?
Yes. I had no idea then of his existence. But from then on, I felt that the chief characters, the chief actors in the drama, whichever way you like to put it, were not on the tour. They were not members of the coach party. I hesitated just for a short time, hesitated over some particular persons. I hesitated, considering Joanna Crawford and Emlyn Price.
Why fix on them?
Because of their youth, said Miss Marple. Because youth is so often associated with suicide, with violence, with intense jealousy and tragic love. A man kills his girl. It happens. Yes, my mind went to them, but it did not seem to me there was any association there. No shadow of evil, of despair, of misery. I used the idea of them later as a kind of false pointer when we were drinking sherry at the old manor house that last evening. I pointed out how they could be the most easy suspects in the death of Elizabeth Temple. When I see them again, said Miss Marple punctiliously, I shall apologize to them for having used them as useful characters to distract attention from my real ideas.
And the next thing was the death of Elizabeth Temple?
No, said Miss Marple. Actually, the next thing was my arrival at the old manor house. The kindness of my reception and taking up my stay there under their hospitable roof. That again had been arranged by Mr. Raphael. So I knew that I must go there, but not for what reason I was to go there. It might be merely a place where more information would come to me to lead me onwards in my quest. I am sorry, Miss Marple said, suddenly becoming her normal, apologetic and slightly fussy self. I am talking at much too great a length. I really must not inflict on you all that I thought and...
Please, go on, said Professor Wanstead. You may not know it, but what you are telling me is particularly interesting to me. It ties up with so much I have known and seen in the work I do. Go on giving me what you felt.
Yes, go on,
said Sir Andrew McNeil.
It was feeling, said Miss Marple. It wasn't really, you know, logical deduction. It was based on a kind of emotional reaction or susceptibility to, well, I can only call it atmosphere.
Yes, said Wanstead, there is atmosphere. Atmosphere in houses, atmosphere in places, in the garden, in the forest, in a public house, in a cottage.
The three sisters. That is what I thought and felt and said to myself when I went into the old manor house. I was so kindly received by Lavinia Glynn. There's something about the phrase, the three sisters, that springs up in your mind as sinister. It combines with the three sisters in Russian literature, the three witches on Macbeth's heath. It seemed to me that there was an atmosphere there of sorrow, of deep-felt unhappiness, also an atmosphere of fear, and a kind of struggling, different atmosphere which I can only describe as an atmosphere of normality.
Your last word interests me, said Wanstead.
It was due, I think, to Mrs. Glynn. She was the one who came to meet me when the coach arrived and explained the invitation. She was an entirely normal and pleasant woman, a widow. She was not very happy, but when I say she was not very happy, it was nothing to do with sorrow or deep unhappiness. It was just that she had the wrong atmosphere for her own character. She took me back with her, and I met the two other sisters. The next morning, I was to hear from an aged housemaid who brought my early morning tea a story of past tragedy, of a girl who had been killed by her boyfriend, of several other girls in the neighbourhood who'd fallen victims to violence or sexual assault. I had to make my second appraisal. I had dismissed the people in the coach as not being personally concerned in my search. Somewhere still, there was a killer. I had to ask myself if one of the killers could be here, here in this house where I had been sent. Clotilde, Lavinia, Anthea. Three names of three weird sisters. Three happy, unhappy, suffering, frightened. What were they?
my attention was caught first by Clotilde, a tall, handsome woman, a personality, just as Elizabeth Temple had been a personality. I felt that here, where the field was limited, I must at least sum up what I could about the three sisters. Three fates. Who could be a killer? What kind of a killer? What kind of a killing? I could feel then, rising up rather slowly like a miasma does, an atmosphere. I don't think there is any other word that expresses it except evil. Not necessarily that any of these three was evil, but they were certainly living in an atmosphere where evil had happened, had left its shadow, or was still threatening them. Clotilde, the eldest, was the first one I considered. She was handsome, she was strong, she was, I thought, a woman of intense emotional feeling. I saw her, I will admit, as a possible Clytemnestra. I had recently, Miss Marple dropped into her everyday tones, been taken, very kindly, to a Greek play performed at a well-known boys' public school not far from my home. I had been very, very impressed by the acting of the Agamemnon, and particularly the performance of the boy who had played Clytemnestra. A very remarkable performance. It seemed to me that in Clotilde I could imagine a woman who could plan and carry out the killing of a husband in his bath. For a moment, Professor Wanstead had all he could do to repress a laugh. It was the seriousness of Miss Marple's tone. She gave him a slight twinkle from her eyes. "Yes, it sounds rather silly, does it not?" said like that. "But I could see her that way, playing that part, that is to say. Very unfortunately, she had no husband. She had never had a husband, and therefore did not kill a husband." Then I considered my guide to the house, Lavinia Glynn. She seemed an extremely nice, wholesome, and pleasant woman. But alas, certain people who have killed have produced much that effect on the world round them. They have been charming people. Many murderers have been delightful and pleasant men, and people have been astonished. They are what I call the respectable killers, the ones who would commit murder from entirely utilitarian motives, without emotion, but to gain a required end. I didn't think it was very likely, and I should be highly surprised if it was so, but I could not leave out Mrs. Glynn. She had had a husband. She was a widow, and had been a widow for some years. It could be. I left it at that. And then I came to the third sister, Anthea. She was a disquieting personality, badly coordinated, it seemed to me, scatterbrained, and in a condition of some emotion which I thought, on the whole, was fear. She was frightened of something, intensely frightened of something. Well, that could fit in, too. If she had committed a crime of some kind, a crime which she had thought was finished with and past, there might have been some recrudescence, some raising up of old problems, something perhaps connected with the Elizabeth Temple inquiries. She might have felt fear that an old crime would be revived or discovered. She had a curious way of looking at you, and then looking sharply from side to side over one shoulder, as though she saw something standing behind her, something that made her afraid. So she, too, was a possible answer, a possibly slightly mentally unhinged killer who could have killed because she considered herself persecuted, because she was afraid. These were only ideas. They were only rather a more pronounced assessment of possibilities that I had already gone through on the coach. But the atmosphere of the house was on me more than ever. That next day, I walked in the garden with Anthea. At the end of the principal grass path was a mound created by the falling down of a former greenhouse. Owing to a lack of repairs and of gardeners at the end of the war, it had fallen into disuse, come to pieces. Bricks had been piled up, surmounted with earth and turf, and had been planted with a certain creeper. A creeper well known when you want to hide or cover some rather ugly pieces of building in your garden. Polygonum, it is called. One of the quickest flowering shrubs, which swallows and kills and dries up and gets rid of everything it grows over. It grows over everything. It is, in its way, a rather frightening plant. It has beautiful white flowers. It can look very lovely. It was not yet in bloom, but it was going to be. I stood there with Anthea, and she seemed to be desperately unhappy over the loss of the greenhouse. She said it had had such lovely grapes. It seemed to be the thing she remembered most about the garden when she had been a child there, and she wanted desperately to have enough money so as to dig up the mound, level the ground, and rebuild the greenhouse, and stock it with muscat grapes and peaches, as the old greenhouse had been. It was a terrible nostalgia for the past she was feeling. It was more than that. Again, very clearly, I felt an atmosphere of fear. Something about the mound made her frightened. I couldn't then think what it was. You know the next thing that happened. It was Elizabeth Temple's death. And there was no doubt from the story told by Emlyn Price and Joanna Crawford that there could be only one conclusion. It was not accident. It was deliberate murder. I think it was from then on, said Miss Marple, that I knew. I came to the conclusion there had been three killings. I heard the full story of Mr. Raphael's son, the delinquent boy, the ex-jailbird, and I thought that he was all those things, but none of them showed him as being a killer or likely to be a killer. All the evidence was against him. There was no doubt in anyone's mind that he had killed the girl whose name I had now learned as being Verity Hunt. But Archdeacon Brabazon put the final crown on the business, as it were. He had known those two young people. They had come to him with their story of wanting to get married, and he had taken it upon himself to decide that they should get married. He thought that it was not perhaps a wise marriage, but it was a marriage that was justified by the fact that they both loved each other. The girl loved the boy with what he called a true love, a love as true as her name. And he thought that the boy, for all his bad sexual reputation, had truly loved the girl and had every intention of being faithful to her and trying to reform some of his evil tendencies. The archdeacon was not optimistic. He did not, I think, believe it would be a thoroughly happy marriage. But it was, to his mind, what he called a necessary marriage. Necessary because if you love enough, you will pay the price, even if the price is disappointment and a certain amount of unhappiness. But one thing I was quite sure of. That disfigured face, that battered-in head, could not have been the action of a boy who really loved the girl. This was not a story of sexual assault. I was ready to take the Archdeacon's word for that, but I knew, too, that I'd got the right clue, the clue that was given me by Elizabeth Temple. She had said that the cause of Verity's death was love, one of the most frightening words there is. It was quite clear then, said Miss Marple. I think I'd known for some time, really. It was just the small things that hadn't fitted in, but now they did. They fitted in with what Elizabeth Temple had said, the cause of Verity's death. She had said first the one word love, and then that love could be the most frightening word there was. It was all mapped out so plainly then, the overwhelming love that Clotilde had had for this girl, the girl's hero worship of her, dependency on her, and then, as she grew a little older, her normal instincts came into play. She wanted love. She wanted to be free to love, to marry, to have children. And along came the boy that she could love. She knew that he was unreliable. She knew that he was what was technically called a bad lot. But that, said Miss Marple, in a more ordinary tone of voice, is not what puts any girl off a boy. No, young women like bad lots. They always have. They fall in love with bad lots. They are quite sure they can change them. And the nice, kind, steady, reliable husbands got the answer, in my young days, that one would be a sister to them, which never satisfied them at all. Verity fell in love with Michael Raphael. and Michael Raphael was prepared to turn over a new leaf and marry this girl, and was sure he would never wish to look at another girl again. I don't say this would have been a happy ever after thing, but it was, as the Archdeacon said, quite surely, it was real love. And so they planned to get married. And I think Verity wrote to Elizabeth and told her that she was going to marry Michael Raphael. It was arranged in secret, because I think Verity did realize that what she was doing was essentially an escape. She was escaping from a life that she didn't want to live any longer, from someone whom she loved very much, but not in the way she loved Michael. And she would not be allowed to do so. Permission would not be willingly given. Every obstacle would be put in their way. So, like other young people, they were going to elope. There was no need for them to fly off to Gretna Green. They were of sufficiently mature age to marry. So she appealed to Archdeacon Brabazon, her old friend who had confirmed her, who was a real friend. And the wedding was arranged, the day, the time, probably even she bought secretly some garment in which to be married. They were to meet somewhere, no doubt. They were to come to the rendezvous separately. I think he came there, but she did not come. He waited, perhaps. Waited, and then tried to find out, perhaps, why she didn't come. I think then a message may have been given him, even a letter sent him, possibly in her forged handwriting, saying she had changed her mind. It was all over, and she was going away for a time to get over it. I don't know, but I don't think he ever dreamt of the real reason of why she hadn't come, of why she had sent no word. He hadn't thought for one moment that she had been deliberately, cruelly, almost madly, perhaps, destroyed. Clotilde was not going to lose the person she loved. She was not going to let her escape. She was not going to let her go to the young man whom she herself hated and loathed. She would keep Verity, keep her in her own way. But what I could not believe was, I did not believe that she'd strangled the girl and had then disfigured her face. I don't think she could have borne to do that. I think that she had rearranged the bricks of the fallen greenhouse and piled up earth and turf over most of it. The girl had already been given a drink, an overdose of sleeping draught, probably. Grecian, as it were, in tradition. One cup of hemlock, even if it wasn't hemlock. And she buried the girl there in the garden, piled the bricks over her, and the earth, and the turf.
Did neither of the other sisters suspect it?
Mrs. Glynn was not there then. Her husband had not died, and she was still abroad. But Anthea was there. I think Anthea did know something of what went on. I don't know that she suspected death at first, but she knew that Clotilde had been occupying herself with the raising up of a mound at the end of the garden, to be covered with flowering shrubs, to be a place of beauty. I think perhaps the truth came to her, little by little. And then Clotilde, having accepted evil, done evil, surrendered to evil, had no qualms about what she would do next. I think she enjoyed planning it. She had a certain amount of influence over a sly, sexy little village girl who came to her cadging for benefits now and then. I think it was easy for her to arrange one day to take the girl on a picnic or an expedition a good long way away, 30 or 40 miles. She'd chosen the place beforehand, I think. She strangled the girl, disfigured her, hid her under turned earth, leaves and branches. Why should anyone ever suspect her of doing any such thing? She put Verity's handbag there, and a little chain Verity used to wear, round her neck, and possibly dressed her in clothes belonging to Verity. She hoped the crime would not be found out for some time, but in the meantime she spread abroad rumours of Nora Broad having been seen about in Michael's car, going about with Michael. Possibly she spread a story that Verity had broken off the engagement to be married because of his infidelity with this girl. She may have said anything, and I think everything she said she enjoyed. Poor lost soul.
Why do you say poor lost soul, Miss Marple?
Because, said Miss Marple, I don't suppose there can be any agony so great as what Clotilde has suffered all this time. 10 years now, living in eternal sorrow. Living, you see, with the thing she had to live with. She had kept Verity, kept her there at the old manor house, in the garden, kept her there forever. She didn't realize at first what that meant. Her passionate longing for the girl to be alive again. I don't think she ever suffered from remorse. I don't think she had even that consolation. She just suffered, went on suffering year after year. And I know now what Elizabeth Temple meant, better perhaps than she herself did. Love is a very terrible thing. It is alive to evil. It can be one of the most evil things there can be. And she had to live with that day after day, year after year. I think, you know, that Anthea was frightened of that. I think she knew more clearly the whole time what Clotilde had done, and she thought that Clotilde knew that she knew, and she was afraid of what Clotilde might do. Clotilde gave that parcel to Anthea to post, the one with the pullover. She said things to me about Anthea, that she was mentally disturbed, that if she suffered from persecution or jealousy, Anthea might do anything. I think, yes, that in the not-so-distant future, something might have happened to Anthea, an arranged suicide because of a guilty conscience.
And yet you are sorry for that woman, asked Sir Andrew. Malignant evil is like cancer, a malignant tumour. It brings suffering.
Of course, said Miss Marple.
I suppose you have been told what happened that night, said Professor Wanstead, after your guardian angels had removed you.
You mean Clotilde? She had picked up my glass of milk, I remember. She was still holding it when Miss Cook took me out of the room. I suppose she drank it, did she?
Yes. Did you know that might happen?
I didn't think of it, no, not at the moment. I suppose I could have known it if I'd thought about it.
Nobody could have stopped her. She was so quick about it, and nobody quite realized there was anything wrong in the milk.
So she drank it.
Does that surprise you?
No. It would have seemed to her the natural thing to do. One can't really wonder. It had come by this time that she wanted to escape from all the things she was having to live with, just as Verity had wanted to escape from the life that she was living there. Very odd, isn't it, that the retribution one brings on oneself fits so closely with what has caused it.
You sound sorrier for her than you were for the girl who died.
No, said Miss Marple. It's a different kind of being sorry. I'm sorry for Verity because of all that she missed, all that she was so near to obtaining, a life of love and devotion and service to the man she had chosen and whom she truly loved, truly and in all Verity. She missed all that, and nothing can give that back to her. I'm sorry for her because of what she didn't have. But she escaped what Clotilde had to suffer. Sorrow, misery, fear, and a growing cultivation and imbibing of evil. Clotilde had to live with all those. Sorrow, frustrated love, which she could never get back. She had to live with the two sisters who suspected, who were afraid of her, and she had to live with the girl she had kept there.
You mean Verity?
Yes, buried in the garden, buried in the tomb that Clotilde had prepared. She was there, in the old manor house, and I think Clotilde knew she was there. It might be that she even saw her, or thought she saw her sometimes, when she went to pick a spray of polygonum blossom. She must have felt very close to Verity then. Nothing worse could happen to her, could it, than that? Nothing worse.
Chapter 23
end pieces.
"That old lady gives me the creeps," said Sir Andrew McNeil, when he had said goodbye and thanks to Miss Marple.
"So gentle and so ruthless," said the Assistant Commissioner.
Professor Wanstead took Miss Marple down to his car, which was waiting, and then returned for a few final words.
"What did you think of her, Edmund?"
"The most frightening woman I ever met," said the Home Secretary.
"Ruthless?" asked Professor Wanstead.
"No, no, I don't mean that, but, well, a very frightening woman."
"Nemesis," said Professor Wanstead, thoughtfully.
"Those two women," said the PPD man. "You know, the security agents who were looking after her, they gave a most extraordinary description of her that night. They got into the house quite easily, hid themselves in a small downstairs room until everyone went upstairs. Then one went into the bedroom and into the wardrobe, and the other stayed outside the room to watch. The one in the bedroom said that when she threw open the door of the wardrobe and came out, there was the old lady sitting up in bed with a pink fluffy shawl round her neck and a perfectly placid face, twittering away and talking like an elderly schoolmarm. They said she gave them quite a turn."
"A pink fluffy shawl?" said Professor Wanstead.
"Yes, yes, I do remember."
"What do you remember?"
"Old Raphael. He told me about her, you know, and then he laughed. He said one thing he'd never forget in all his life. He said it was when one of the funniest, scatterbrained old pussies he'd ever met came marching into his bedroom out in the West Indies with a fluffy pink scarf round her neck, telling him he was to get up and do something to prevent a murder. And he said, 'What on earth do you think you're doing?' And she said she was Nemesis."
Nemesis.
He could not imagine anything less like it, he said.
"I like the touch of the pink woolly scarf," said Professor Wanstead thoughtfully.
"I like that very much."
"Michael," said Professor Wanstead, "I want to introduce you to Miss Jane Marple, who's been very active on your behalf."
The young man of 32 looked at the white-haired, rather dicky old lady with a slightly doubtful expression.
Oh, he said. "Well, I guess I have heard about it. Thanks very much."
He looked at Wanstead.
"It's true, is it? They're going to give me a free pardon or something silly like that?"
"Yes. A release will be put through quite soon. You'll be a free man in a very short time."
"Oh." Michael sounded slightly doubtful. "It will take a little getting used to, I expect," said Miss Marple kindly. She looked at him thoughtfully, seeing him in retrospect as he might have been 10 years or so ago. Still quite attractive, though he showed all the signs of strain. Attractive, yes. Very attractive, she thought he would have been once. A gaiety about him then there would have been, and a charm. He'd lost that now, but it would come back, perhaps. A weak mouth and attractively shaped eyes that could look you straight in the face and probably had been always extremely useful for telling lies that you really wanted to believe. Very like... who was it? She dived into past memories. Jonathan Birkin, of course. He had sung in the choir, a really delightful baritone voice, and how fond the girls had been of him. Quite a good job he'd had as a clerk in Messrs. Gabriel's firm. A pity there had been that little matter of the checks.
"Oh," said Michael.
He said, with even more embarrassment,
"It's been very kind of you, I'm sure, to take so much trouble."
"I've enjoyed it," said Miss Marple. "Well, I'm glad to have met you. Goodbye. I hope you've got a very good time coming to you. Our country is in rather a bad way just now, but you'll probably find some job or other that you might quite enjoy doing."
"Oh, yes. Thanks. Thanks very much. I really am very grateful, you know."
His tone sounded still extremely unsure about it. "It's not me you ought to be grateful to," said Miss Marple. "You ought to be grateful to your father."
"Dad? Dad never thought much of me."
Your father, when he was a dying man, was determined to see that you got justice.
Justice. Michael Raphael considered it.
Yes, your father thought justice was important. He was, I think, a very just man himself. In the letter he wrote me asking me to undertake this proposition, he directed me to a quotation. Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an everlasting stream.
Oh, what's it mean? Shakespeare?
No, the Bible. One has to think about it. I had to. Miss Marple unwrapped a parcel she had been carrying. They gave me this, she said. They thought I might like to have it, because I had helped to find out the truth of what had really happened. I think, though, that you are the person who should have first claim on it. That is, if you really want it. But maybe you do not want it.
She handed him the photograph of Verity Hunt that Clotilde Brabbery Scott had shown her once in the drawing-room of the old manor house. He took it and stood with it, staring down on it. His face changed. The lines of it softened, then hardened. Miss Marple watched him without speaking. The silence went on for some little time. Professor Wanstead also watched. He watched them both, the old lady and the boy. It came to him that this was, in some way, a crisis, a moment that might affect a whole new way of life. Michael Raphael sighed. He stretched out and gave the photograph back to Miss Marple. No, you're right. I do not want it. All that life is gone. She's gone. I can't keep her with me. Anything I do now has got to be new, going forward. You... He hesitated, looking at her. You understand?
Yes, said Miss Marple. I understand. I think you are right. I wish you good luck in the life you are now going to begin.
He said goodbye and went out. Well, said Professor Wanstead, not an enthusiastic young man. He could have thanked you a bit more enthusiastically for what you did for him.
Oh, that's quite all right, said Miss Marple. I didn't expect him to do so. It would have embarrassed him even more. It is, you know, she added, very embarrassing when one has to thank people and start life again and see everything from a different angle and all that. I think he might do well. He's not bitter, that's the great thing. I understand quite well why that girl loved him.
Well, perhaps he'll go straight this time.
One rather doubts that, said Miss Marple. I don't know that he'd be able to help himself, unless, of course, she said. The great thing to hope for is that he'll meet a really nice girl.
What I like about you, said Professor Wanstead, is your delightfully practical mind. She'll be here presently, said Mr. Broadrib to Mr. Schuster.
Yes, whole thing's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
I couldn't believe it at first, said Broadrib. You know, when poor old Raphael was dying, I thought this whole thing was, well, senility or something. Not that he was old enough for that.
The buzzer went. Mr. Schuster picked up the phone.
Oh, she's here, is she? Bring her up, he said.
She's come, he said. I wonder now. You know, it's the oddest thing I ever heard in my life, getting an old lady to go racketing round the countryside, looking for she doesn't know what. The police think, you know, that that woman committed not just one murder, but three. Three, I ask you. Verity Hunt's body was under the mound in the garden, just as the old lady said it was. She hadn't been strangled, and the face was not disfigured.
I wonder the old lady herself didn't get done in, said Mr. Broadrib. Far too old to be able to take care of herself. She had a couple of detectives, apparently, looking after her.
What, two of them?
Yes, I didn't know that.
Miss Marple was ushered into their room.
"Congratulations, Miss Marple," said Mr. Broadrib, rising to greet her.
"Very best wishes. Splendid job," said Mr. Schuster, shaking hands.
Miss Marple sat down composedly on the other side of the desk.
"As I told you in my letter,"
she said. "I think I have fulfilled the terms of the proposition that was made to me. I have succeeded in what I was asked to do."
"Oh, I know. Yes, we've heard already. We've heard from Professor Wanstead and from the legal department and from the police authorities. Yes, it's been a splendid job, Miss Marple. We congratulate you."
"I was afraid," said Miss Marple, "that I would not be able to do what was required of me. It seems so very difficult, almost impossible at first."
"Yes, indeed, it seems quite impossible to me. I don't know how you did it, Miss Marple."
"Oh, well," said Miss Marple, "it's just perseverance, isn't it, that leads to things?"
"No, about the sum of money we are holding. It's at your disposal at any time now. I don't know whether you would like us to pay it into your bank, or whether you would like to consult us, possibly, as to the investment of it. It's quite a large sum."
£20,000, said Miss Marple. "Yes, it is a very large sum by my way of thinking. Quite extraordinary," she added.
"If you would like an introduction to our brokers, they could give you possibly some ideas about investing."
"Oh, I don't want to invest any of it."
"But surely it would be—"
"There's no point in saving at my age," said Miss Marple. "I mean, the point of this money, I'm sure Mr. Raphael meant it that way, is to enjoy a few things that one thought one never would have the money to enjoy."
"Well, I see your point of view," said Mr. Broadrib. "Then your instructions would be that we pay this sum of money into your bank?"
"Middleton's Bank, 132 High Street, St. Mary Mead," said Miss Marple.
"You have a deposit account, I expect. We will place it to your deposit account."
"Certainly not," said Miss Marple. "Put it into my current account."
"You don't think—"
"I do think," said Miss Marple. "I want it in my current account." She got up and shook hands.
"You could ask your bank manager's advice, you know, Miss Marple. It really is. One never knows when one wants something for a rainy day."
"The only thing I shall want for a rainy day will be my umbrella," said Miss Marple. She shook hands with them both again. "Thank you so much, Mr. Broadrib, and you too, Mr. Schuster. You've been so kind to me, giving me all the information I needed."
"You really want that money put into your current account?"
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "I'm going to spend it, you know. I'm going to have some fun with it." She looked back from the door, and she laughed. Just for one moment, Mr. Schuster, who was a man of more imagination than Mr. Broadrib, had a vague impression of a young and pretty girl shaking hands with the vicar at a garden party in the country. It was, as he realized a moment later, a recollection of his own youth, but Miss Marple had, for a minute, reminded him of that particular girl, young, happy, going to enjoy herself. "Mr. Raphael would have liked me to have fun," said Miss Marple. She went out of the door.
"Nemesis," said Mr. Broadrib. "That's what Raphael called her, Nemesis. Never seen anybody less like Nemesis, have you?"
Mr. Schuster shook his head.
"It must have been another of Mr. Raphael's little jokes," said Mr. Broadrib.
This has been a presentation of BBC Audiobooks America. Nemesis, a Miss Marple mystery. Text copyright 1971 by Agatha Christie Limited, a Corian company. Production copyright 2008 by BBC Audiobooks America. All rights reserved.